This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Vandeclere kicks! Vandeclere's won it for Australia! They're on top of the world!
Bling It On from Colt 31 and Bling It On! The comeback boys done it! Bling It On first!
It's still Rajasthan in front and Rajasthan wins the Sandown Cup.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to Cracking the Codes. Matt, Dan and Simone. It's a really busy day across the three codes today and tonight. We've got the Cranbourne Cup Harness tonight. We've got the Ballarat Cup Greyhound Heats tonight. Pakenham Cup in the Gallops. And, of course, my love for Balnarring. We'll take me to Balnarring. And Healesville tomorrow.
Yes.
Two picnics in 2 days, close together. It's going to be a ripper.
Of course, Werribee Cup tomorrow and the big Italian Cup plate day at Tatura, which is huge as well.
How do we fit it all in?
Is there ever a quiet time in racing?
Well, no, that's
I don't think
point.
So.
And this time of the year, while it seems like it's a quieter time because we're away from the carnivals, the truth is there are more meetings at this time
Christmas,
of the year
New
than
year.
Any other time of the year.
Crazy, crazy. But good, in a good way. What have you been up to, Simone?
Oh, plenty.
I said that in an accusatory way, didn't I? What have you been up to, Simone?
Oh, plenty. There's always plenty to do when you've got animals, I guess, and racing going on. The Melbourne Cup last week, of course, and Ballarat Cup heats tonight. And Matt, interested to hear about the Jericho last Sunday, because from all accounts, apart from the weather, which you would expect when you're in Warrnambool, I lived there for 9 years, it received a lot of very positive feedback and just over social media. So interested to hear how that went for you.
You know, there's social media is the haven for narcs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And you cop it every day, but it's a fascinating thing about the Jericho Cup. I've never read one negative tweet or post about the Jericho Cup because it's such an overwhelmingly good idea. So I went down last with the kids after we did our inside-outside broadcast, Dan, in the studio, and we drove down. Ollie lost a side bet in the car, so his punishment was 5 minutes in the Southern Ocean. Does that sound like
child abuse?
So he did that.
The Southern Ocean is quite south, so I wonder how far down you actually went.
Oh, no, from the beach. And it is supposed to be summer, so it doesn't sound like child abuse because it is summer. So Max and I felt sorry for him, so we all went in up to our neck for 5 minutes and we all came out with almost fatal pneumonia or whatever it is that you can hear through the airwaves this morning. But so the Jericho was run in terrible conditions. It was just, it was tragic.
You say terrible, but, you know, you put it into perspective in the actual Jericho Cup when it was first run on, tipping was in worse conditions.
Well, yes, and with the worst conditions around it as well. So really cold weather, horrible rain and wind and sleet and hail and people running for shelter and so on. And there was a major renovation going on to the facility. They're rebuilding the Matilda Bar on a new grandstand, so it was very difficult to navigate around the course. So the second running of the Jericho Cup had a lot against it, but against all that, as soon as they started playing the last, so the infantrymen would walk up and down on their ponies all day, and everyone was in awe of the old soldiers in their get-up because of, especially the older ones, who everyone knew that they'd been through battles and so on. So there was an immense reverence for the soldiers. And then when they started playing the last post about half an hour before the Jericho Cup, everyone, from 5-year-olds to 95-year-olds, was dead silent, not even a cough or a splutter. I saw old men dabbing their eyes and so on and wondered what the story was, and with them, and then there was national anthems and then the race and all in rain and so on. So against a brutal backdrop, it was still a wonderful event. And Simone and I were talking earlier, weren't we, about what the future might hold for the Jericho Cup. And even in Warrnambool in the first week of December, you can't rely on the weather. I still have a dream of it being run in the school holidays where you would get 20,000 picnickers sitting there in 26 degrees and making the attendance reflective of the significance of the event. So anyway, it was great. It was a great day.
That's good. They had a community day at the Meadows as well. So the community days are to promote greyhounds as pets, of course. There are greyhounds there that can be adopted, 13 when home, but almost 1,000 people turned up to this community day where they can bring their dogs or just learn about the breed. They have doggy dog washers and food trucks and just information there from the many volunteers that help out with GAP and the rehoming and the other rehoming agencies as well that do a wonderful job. So just the fact that you've got people that are making the effort to go to these places, go to a racetrack, they perhaps have never been there before, but they can just see what it looks like, see how it's maintained. I mean, the Meadows is very picturesque out there, stuck in the suburbs, but the gardens always look amazing. It's very well manicured. The track looks amazing. So for people to go and experience that for the first time, think, oh, hang on a minute. The dogs aren't locked in tiny cages out in the back of the, you know, the sticks of the place, the venue. So just to go out, I think that is one very, very positive thing that comes out of these community days. But the fact that people can go and learn about the breed, they might be a bit unsure whether it's going to suit their lifestyle, if they live in an apartment or if they live in the suburbs, but they can go and speak to people who have had that experience. So another very successful community day where, like I said, 13 greyhounds found their new homes, and it's always adoption day at the Seymour Kennels.
Beautiful.
So if people did miss out there, or they're just unsure and still making their mind up, they can always go out to Seymour.
You've touched on something there that I want to ask you about, Dan, and that is the beautification of the venue. And overseas racing jurisdictions, you walk into a racetrack in France or England and you're overwhelmed by the grandeur and the beauty, and it's great that the Meadows looks good. Sandown Park also does. One of the little knocks I've got on Tabcorp Park Melton, and even the opening day when I went to cover it years ago, was lack of beautification. And, you know, and I know it's a functional venue and it's all about revenue and turnover and so on, but I think, and even the infield, you'll know it from your perched position there. I think they have to do more to make it attractive.
Yeah, there's some trotting tracks in North America, particularly in Canada, that you know, you get your Woodbine. They're the most beautiful-looking harness tracks that you would come across. And you mentioned a lot of the European tracks, particularly through France, Germany, and even if you go further, Czech Republic, even Poland. Like, there's some absolutely stunning to the eye visually. And remember, all the races nowadays are on the TV through the Sky outlets. You want to have them appealing to the eye aesthetically. I'm the sort of person that will bet at venues that look attractive.
Yeah,
there are some places, you know, often that comes down to a bad TV camera angle. I generally won't have a bet there because I feel like I'm being misled.
And our harness tracks, and this is a challenge to them, is to make them look less industrial. Every time I watch a harness race on TV, I see corrugated iron, you know, the sponsors boards around the back, piles of dirt in the infield and things like that. You know, long grass and stuff. I just think it should be a basic requirement to make it an attractive place.
At least
place.
In New Zealand, you'll have sheep or cattle running through it, maybe a golf course.
Don't take me through the joke about the sheep in the infield.
Well, there was a kangaroo at the Meadows the other morning, caught on camera, hopping down the track. I don't know, it's about 3 a.m. or 5 a.m. They caught it on their camera. At the Meadows, yes.
At Melton, there's a big mob of kangaroos. I tell everyone, because I've got binoculars, obviously, I've got the best view in the place, and I tell them right next to us, behind the car park where the float car park is, and there's a mob of about 20 kangaroos, and you wonder where they come from. There's an open enough space, but it's built up nearly all the way around the 360 degree. Where are they coming from? But there's a lot of places that's the case. We have snakes coming across the track, and the workers, you know, you just have to walk on the track and you see the snake track across going to the little, creek, but a little watering hole that's inside the track. I mean, they are there, and some of the more alienated tracks country-wise and gallop-wise for that matter, there's a heck of a lot more Australian native wildlife. We've seen the corellas at certain places and the seagulls at other places. There are some of the racetracks.
Kangaroos at Bendigo. I've seen that before too.
Well, they had they called off the races at Hanging Rock because the kangaroos jumped over the fence and ran all over the track.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah,
that happened a couple of years in a row. But we've had incidences with birds, and there are some venues, and not just the thoroughbred venues, some of the sporting venues have either hawks or eagles to scare away the higher population, particularly of seagull. I think even the MCG.
They had an eagle at the MCG years ago that was supposed to swoop down and scare off the scavenging seagulls. Well, fascinating stuff. So look, I'm not having a go at harness racing, but I just think you could make your tracks look a little bit prettier. Hey, last week we spoke to Peter Gavin about, I loved his soft language and the way he wanted to change words like bull ring and breaking in and so on. And he's a re-educator. And Simone, one of our guests this morning, Karen Leake, sort of fits vaguely under the same umbrella as far as the education part of the greyhound, the rearing and so on.
She sure does. And many very astute rearers, and I'm sure Karen will say this as well, it's the raring, if it, you don't get the raring right, you may as well forget about the rest. And Barry Smith, who's one of the greatest rarers ever, and his line's gone on for about 40 years down in the down Warrnambool Way, little place called Mapunga. He said it's all about the raring. He's on a dairy farm. The dogs get unlimited meat and milk, which is just your simple raw ingredient. So he thinks that, you know, raring is everything. And Karen's reared some amazing dogs over the years, and consistently dogs that make it to Group 1 finals, dogs that win Group 1 finals. So heading back from the Peter Gavin story, you know, her job is to get them into a condition to pass on to someone like Peter. And I must say, Matt, some really good feedback on Peter Gavin. And you brought it to my attention. I'm just so used to the words, you know, dog breaker. Don't even think about it. I know exactly what it means and what occurs. But like you mentioned, the language that Peter used, he's really made me think how I speak about it as
breaking,
well.
Breaking makes it sound like you're beating them. You know, like you're conquering them, breaking their spirits.
And so it's probably come from that old horse term from the breakers, you know, years ago, we're breaking the horse's spirit. That's probably where it came from, and it's just sort of stuck. Although we're not trying to break a dog's spirit, we're trying to encourage it and say, let's go. And so I think, yeah, Karen certainly is a step back from the education. But
looking forward to having a chat to Karen. Dan, we're also just in bullet points. We're going to have a chat to Scotty Gullen, who is a part owner of London, the mighty London Fog, whose career now takes him to a role as a police horse. So we'll talk to our good mate Scotty Gullen about that. We're going to talk to Brian Martin, who was part of the original paintbrush digging hole planting posts crew back in 2005 with Living Legends. And of course, it won an award, a tourism award recently. We're going to have a chat to Brian Martin about a little bit of history there. A bit of a tribute to the mighty Kingston Town. Of course, the Kingston Town Classic being run today. And just a snapshot, give us an insight into what David Scott's up to at Cranbourne with his harness syndicate.
Well, he really is Mr. Cranbourne, David Scott, a former CEO, newly elected
Sounds
president.
Different than Mr. Hollywood, doesn't it, Mr. Cranbourne?
Mr. Cranbourne, I think he'll be happy with that title too. Newly elected president, Bill Hutchison had been the president there for about 7 or 8 years of the Cranbourne Harness Racing Club. So David has got that role now. But he's also one of the masterminds of this harness racing syndicate, which you really don't hear about professional syndicates owning harness horses. It might be syndicates, but privately set up. There is a Racer Pacer syndicate set up by and endorsed by Harness Racing Victoria. So David, Cranbourne Club, Neil Bainbridge was involved as well, and the team that are there, they've got their own harness training centre.
Uh-huh.
They've relocated some trainers there over the last few years. It's been a very successful setup. Got their heads together to get as many people as they can with tiny little shares and horses, groups of horses, like up to about 7 that they've got.
Right.
They've just got it off the ground. They've had a recent winner, horse that's going to run in a Group 1 race in a couple of weeks, and David will explain. I think there's still opportunities to get involved and race with them, the Club 21 Cranbourne Harness Syndicate.
Well, he can tell us all about that when he joins us. First up, though, we're going to have a chat to Karen Leake about the importance of rearing greyhounds.
This is RSN Cracking the Codes.
And after last week's conversation with greyhound educator Peter Gavin, I've decided to take it back one step further, and that's the job of rearing greyhounds or pups to get them to that stage where they can start to be educated. And one of the most astute rearers in the country, who's been very astute for a long, long time, is Karen Leake. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Simone.
You've had so much success, Karen, over many, many years of rearing some top-line greyhounds, including Get It Gizmo, who was recently in the Melbourne Cup. But greyhounds like Marrera, Phenomenal, Bewildering, Extreme Magic, they're just recent ones. But have you got any memories of ones that take us back a little bit further as well?
Yeah, well, mainly my own ones. You know, I had a dog called Proud Paul many years ago. Actually, I didn't rear him. Sandra Reed reared him, and she was the one that taught me all I knew about rearing dogs. And he was a really good dog. He made 2 Melbourne Cup finals. I think he ran 3rd in one of them. And then we go back to a lovely dog that I reared and bred, a dog called Time Flies. And he had a lot of injuries and that, but he was just a super dog. And to this day, I think he's the best dog ever put a collar and lead on. Copper Lady, Judy Thomas, reared her. And again, she had a big impact on me rearing dogs and how to rear them. She made a Melbourne Cup final, was very unlucky not to win the Melbourne Cup. Rustic Venture knocked her out of it on the first turn. So I think I got cheated out of that one.
What is it that's been the consistent factor for you with rearing greyhounds over many, many years successfully?
Look, I think the main thing is, look, you've got to look after them. You know, they've got to be fed well. a lot of people have this idea that you just feed pups rubbish. I think pups need to be fed as good, if not better, than what your race dogs need to be fed, because you're developing an athlete for the future. So they have to have something good inside of them, you know. So my pups, they drink cow's milk. I have a very lucky to have a young lady that gives me fresh cow's milk, and they get fresh cow's milk. They get calcium as well. They get same beef as what my race dogs get, or actually race dogs get room meat now, but is what they used to get. And yeah, I still go back to the basic of using bread, use wholemeal bread for them, and plus dry food, but mainly bread. And yeah, look, just look after them and worm them well. Keep them, when I say keep them clean, keep them basically clean, but they must have a clean, dry, warm bed to sleep in as well.
If you rear them wrong, in inverted commas, what can be the impact on the greyhound as it matures and grows? If you're feeding them the wrong thing and treating them the wrong way, what can be the medium to long term effect on the greyhound?
They just won't stand up to it. You know, their constitution just will not stand up to the racing. They will probably only be able to run 300 meters, not run 500 meters. It just makes up a better athlete if you've got more substance about you, you know.
So it's like, Karen, your role, at what age are you getting the greyhounds? Are you getting them as straight from the breeders, or breeding them yourselves, or is there a certain age that you'll take them from and rear them? It's almost like a nanny role or a foster mother almost.
Yeah, look, normally about 3.5. They have their final vaccination at 3 months, and we like them to stay where they are for 2 weeks after their final vaccination, just because the vaccination sort of stresses the system a little bit too without moving them at the same time. So they stay there for 2 weeks and come to me at about 3.5 months. And they normally go off to get broken in between 13 to 14 months. So they spend probably 12 months here.
Because they're only little, do you have them in the house?
No. But I definitely don't come in the house. No, look, I've got different areas where I have them. I've got a nice big yard beside me, which opens into a probably about an acre and a half paddock that has a dam in it. We don't use the dam so much now because there's a lot of wildlife around the dam, and the pups spend half the time in the dam chasing the wildlife.
Well, I thought they might have been in drawers, you know, like in drawers in the bedroom, like in... cartoon? You open a drawer and there's little puppies in there?
Matt hasn't seen 3-month-old pups or 3.5 months. I've got a litter at home and they're just, they're like land sharks. You walk in there and they just want to grab your legs and jump on you.
That's right, and making an absolute mess out of you. So, no, they definitely do not come into the house, but they've got their own areas and they have a good time. And then they've got toys to play with. We give them toys and little teddy bears. Go to the op shops and get little teddy bears and things for them, and... yeah.
Are most greyhounds reared well, or is there a contrast between what you do and some of the worst examples of greyhound rearing?
Look, I think today, I think dogs are much better reared today than what they were years ago. Another thing that I do that a lot of people don't do is I still cook chicken and meat stews for them, and they get stewed probably twice a week. And that was something that I used to do years ago a lot of. And a lot of people don't do that now. They get the same food all the time. Well, mine don't. They get stews twice a week, and they'll get dry food instead of the bread once a week, mixed with their meat. And, yeah, it's a little bit of variety just to keep a little bit interesting what's coming on their plate each day.
I think you've raised a really good point, Matt. And, Karen, I know you'll agree with me. So you would have lived through that time where we had so many rearing farms where there was hundreds of pups on the farms, and it's done en masse, basically, whereas it just goes to prove that your small boutique style of rearing has just lived through all that, and the ones that were perhaps bigger rearing farms just didn't quite last, did they? Or the dogs didn't stand up to it, like you mentioned.
No, they didn't, you know. They weren't looked after. I mean, my dogs have got their beds cleaned out about every, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, and they're on shredded paper. And
it's the same as Dan's bedroom, 4 to 6 weeks, changes the sheets.
That's not quite the truth. I've got a wife. Maddie sort of has to look after his own bed.
I meant my sheets, not his.
Mine get done a bit more regular than that too.
Mind you, my dogs are inside though, so there might be an element of truth to that.
Well, Karen, we've heard about your rearing and how you do it, but like we've mentioned, you've read some outstanding chases, and Get It Gizmo, who recently won the Top Gun, was in the Melbourne Cup, in the Ballarat Cup heats tonight. But let's just read relive that Top Gun memory.
And go to the back straight and get it, Gizmo the leader. Got to the back straight about 2.5 to 3 clear. Feral Frankie second, followed by Whiskey Ride, who's third. They were followed then by Black Opium. Next to the outside, Good Odds Arata, followed by Shimmer Shine. And well back, Baringa Brett coming up to the turn. Get it, Gizmo the leader. Leads the Top Gun field for home clear. And get it, Gizmo's going to win the race by about 2.5 to 3. Feral Frankie, Whiskey Ride third. And then
Karen, can you just describe what that was like for you as someone who's seen that greyhound and... You know, you've nurtured him and got him to a place where he's capable of winning a Group 1.
If you could have seen me in the lounge room, I was jumping up and down. I'm glad I was on my own because I just went hysterical. You know, I was screaming at the TV and went hysterical, and I was just, you'd reckon I owned the dog, fair dinkum, but I was just so wrapped because he's just a lovely little dog, you know, and he just tries his little butt off.
Oh, no doubt. And, of course, you trained Din Sun back in 2010. He won the Shepparton Cup there. So you have had plenty of success, but I think it's your legacy of rearing top-class dogs that just continues on. It really sets you apart from many other rearers, Karen.
Look, I try hard, and I'm probably lucky that I'm only small, and I have a few people that I train for, and I'm lucky that they buy very nice pups.
You're a legend. You and Peter Gavin and all these people that are parts of the puzzle that create these greyhounds and help keep them on track and look after them, you're the behind-the-scenes legends. So good on you, Karen, and well done to you.
And thank you very much.
Karen Leek there, who is a rearer. And it is a holistic sort of thing, isn't it? Start to finish, do it well every step of the way, and you'll have a good product and a happy dog.
And even now, it's even more so because we have the lack of volume that we used to have. So it used to be just, you know, breed the numbers, and if you got a couple of good ones out of that, that was people's mentality. Where now the huge gravitational shift, which we've needed and across all three codes, is we are breeding less, but we're breeding better and we're doing it better. And we had to move with the times. It just wasn't sustainable the way that it was done years ago.
Hey, Dan, we're going to take a break on cracking the codes. And when we come back, we're going to have a chat to David Scott about this Club 21 syndicate. But for now, let's take a break.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the codes.
We don't hear a lot about syndications in harness. Certainly syndications that are promoted. They've got to be registered. And there's only one official one endorsed by Harness Racing Victoria, and that is of Racer Pacer, which has been around for a while. But the idea here was to create a new syndicate that is called Club 21 from the Cranbourne Harness Racing Club, and it was the brainchild of probably a number of people, but the person best placed to tell us all about it and how it's unfolded and the way it is emerging is the new president of the Harness Racing Club at Cranbourne, former CEO, harness racing enthusiast. I can see them building a stand for you in the future. David Scott, hello. Thanks for joining us, mate.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you for such a wonderful introduction.
As long as it's not called the David Scott Memorial Stand, because you'll know you've passed.
Thanks very much, Matt. That's a nice thought too.
But you're very, very proud and passionate of all areas of harness racing, particularly that of Cranbourne. And I think it was an area that you've identified a little while ago with the harness racing going to Melton. Cranbourne's probably come a little bit more isolated, Dave, and you've been involved in a number of ventures there to help Cranbourne. We have some wonderful racing there. It's Cup Night tonight. We'll get to that in a second. But the syndicate, the Club 21 syndicate, how did you come up with that idea?
Well, as you rightly say, Dan, we're somewhat isolated, and we recognise that we've got to help ourselves, and to do so we need to build participation out here at Cranbourne. We've successfully done small syndicates in the past with 8 or 10 people racing one horse, but Neil Bainbridge, our CEO, put this idea forward, and that was to have 100 people involved in racing a team of 7 horses. A number of benefits to that, not the least of which is it gives us an opportunity to make it a real social experience. There's not much you can do with small groups of 8 and 10 people. 100 people involved gives you the opportunity to do something meaningful for those people in terms of race day events and communication. And the 7-horse team, we hope, provides ongoing interest, not just peaks and troughs during the year that we can, with a team of 7 horses, have something for these people to be enthusiastic about all year round.
Why are syndicates in the embryonic stage in harness racing, but they've been a staple for gallops for so long? And I don't know what this. I know George Ferrugia and Simone has. There are little syndicates emerging in greyhound racing, but Dave, why has it taken harness racing? Why have syndicates not been part of the harness scene up until now?
I don't quite know, Matt. And we took a lesson from the thoroughbred industry. In fact, Robbie Griffiths was helpful in the early days of when we were putting this idea together. We actually used Robbie as a sounding board. And the differences are quite, as you say, quite marked.
But I know Paces Australia, Terry Henderson's involvement back in the late 80s and 90s, you would have thought that might have led to it becoming a bit bigger, because he was quite successful with the horses he's had at that time, Dave, and also the people that were involved. But
might be the affordability issue. You know, a thoroughbred might cost $200,000 and cost $140 a day to train. Maybe it becomes something that a syndicate can afford more readily than the average harness.
As in a smaller
story.
Percentage, yeah. Whereas in the harness horse, you're more likely to have 5 and 10%, yeah. Which is quite possible. But, Dave, you got your training centre there, so it's a combination of looking after your venue, which is a magnificent venue. The training centre, you've been able to help relocate a couple of trainers, of which those trainers are preparing the horses in the Club 21 syndicate.
Yeah, as you say, so it's a holistic approach to increasing participation. As you point out, we've been successful in attracting two trainers in the past 12 months to our centre. Dylan Stratford, a former Kiwi, who's been domiciled with us for about a year, and most recently Scott Ewan has come across from South Australia. And certainly we used the Club 21 model and promise of horses to train as leverage at attracting those people into the training complex.
And the training centre itself, Dave, it's produced a lot of winners in a fairly short period of time. So they're pretty modern facilities, and the use of the actual professional racetrack is huge for maintaining the interest of the local harness trainers.
It is indeed. We've been in operation since late 2012. We've had just over 240 winners in that time, so we're winning our share of races, and importantly, we do have a number of horses that race locally now. And so, where in the past we might have been wholly dependent on drawing our fields from across the other side of town, it's not uncommon now for us to have 8 and 10 and 12 runners at a Cranbourne meeting that are literally walking across the float park.
The thing I really like about this, David, is it's really affordable, and particularly if you're trying to get young people into the sport who might have mortgages and just starting a new job, $300 up front and then $20 a week across 7 horses. I think it sounds like a very, very good offer. And I liken it to the ready-to-race auctions that we've just had with the greyhounds, where it's almost buy today, race tomorrow. And I think this generation, or perhaps the generation you're targeting, are those people that want that immediacy. They want to buy it today and be able to see it race tomorrow, and I think you give them that opportunity.
Beautiful segue, Simone. We've actually got a horse, a three-year-old trotting filly, Naked Ambition, who started racing in October. Now, the syndicate members only came on board from March onwards. She's now won 2 of her first 3 starts. We'll go round in the VicBred Platinum Series, the heat starting on Monday. So as you say, there's an immediacy about the model. And coming up behind that filly and a 5-year-old trotter that we've got fend off, there are 5 well-bred 2-year-old pacers and trotters, and hopefully 2 or 3 of those will be at the races not so long after Christmas.
And so there are still opportunities for potential syndicate members to get involved, Dave, at the moment?
Yes, that's right, Dan. We still have shares available in that venture. So it's, as you say, 100 members racing 7 horses. We will take on new members on the basis that they will be responsible for their contributions back to the 1st of March. But we're happy to defer those and take those out of future distributions that we're sure will come the way of members.
So really, you could still be in the ownership of that horse, Naked Ambition, in the lead up to the Group 1?
And in fact, enjoy the stake money that she's won thus far. So Yeah, wow, so you're not joining from today with future earnings. You're joining from the 1st of March, and we'll accommodate that.
Guess who's going in? She said out the back she's going in, and she's going to make a commitment to it now.
Might be her husband's her name is Christmas
Simone,
present.
Her name is Simone Fisher, and she's about to pledge a commitment.
Isn't that a great idea, though? Simone just said it's a lovely Christmas present. I think that is so true. What a wonderful way to give someone that is interested in harness racing a little share in this syndicate as a Christmas present.
And an easy way to get into it, because you don't have to do the homework about, is this horse... I wouldn't know what to buy in a harness horse. I wouldn't know whether it's worth the money, but you've taken all the hard work out of it.
And we have Naked Ambition, the horse, it's the mother of Naked Ambition, is called Starkers. We had a lot of fun naming that one, Dave.
We did.
It's a walk-up start name, that one. Hey, Dave, just before we let you go... I've got a lot of mates down at Cranbourne in both the harness and gallops world, and there's obviously a big greyhound presence as well. When you have a big meeting like the Cranbourne Cup tonight, do you get a bit of crossover? Do you get a few of the gallops people coming along and a bit of a mishmash in the crowd?
We do. Not uncommon for Mick Kent to be seen at the harness racing. He's a keen harness racing follower. And from the greyhound world, there's often quite a crossover.
Mick Kent lurking around in the dark with his dark glasses on.
It sets a scene, doesn't it? A visual scene.
Hiding around corners with a bunger out the side of his mouth. I can say that because I'm a mate of his.
I just gave you the name.
Dave, look, for people wanting to get involved in this syndicate, what's the best way that they can go about it? Through either email or phone call?
Easiest is to either phone the club on 599-613-00 or simply Google us, cranbourneharness.org.au.
And it's the Cranbourne Club 21 Syndicate.
That's it.
Oh, good stuff, mate. Look forward to seeing you later on tonight for a wonderful Cranbourne Cup meeting. You got the Trotters Cup as a ripper and the Pacing Cup.
Yeah.
Actually, this season we've been rather blessed that the Pacing Cups have had so much depth. Emma Stewart's stable are so strong and are dominating them, but with different horses seemingly each cup.
Correct. And this time out, Hurricane Harley flies the flag, I guess, for the team. And we're looking forward to see what he might be able to do on our track.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good on you, Dave.
Thanks very much, Matt. Thanks, Simone, and thanks, Dan.
That is fascinating. I know, I don't want to harp on a point, but how syndicates are such a basic function of thoroughbred racing, but they're very foreign to the other two codes, and maybe it is a bit what we're talking about, the economy of it, so on, Dan, but I'm not really sure.
And the registration aspect of it now, it's got pretty serious, even in the thoroughbred world, to be registered, and there are costs involved to do that and to be solvent as well and to have someone reputable running it. There have been situations perhaps in the past which led it to go to that extreme. So perhaps a little bit more difficult, time-consuming, and a little bit more money in the setup. But once it's there, it can work really well. And it's great to see something's happening. And what's always the most important thing for any syndication is to have a bit of success early.
Yeah, exactly. Simone, what's the story with syndicates in the dog world?
There are a few. There's one called Spolly Syndications, which is quite good down Gippsland way, and then with this national draft, of course, this is getting new people into the sport as well via syndication as well. I think there's a few little syndicates, but it's a lot more affordable with a greyhound, so you don't need to have 100 or 200 or 300 people in a syndicate. People, it's more just, you know, family members getting together.
Well, our next guest is very experienced in the area of syndicates and racing clubs and so on, but first, there's a lot of things we're going to talk to Brian Martin about. One of them is Living Legends, one of them is racing syndicates, and the other one is this.
When they turn for home, it's a Copperway first into the straight, 2 metres in front with a giant heart of Gamelite. Gamelite moved up on the outside. He won't give in, Gamelite. He's got to Copperway halfway down the running. And this marvellous pacer took the lead now, Gamelite. He's 2 metres in front. He's 3 metres in front of Copperway. They're clear of Rengali, followed by Treeburn, a marvellous horse. Gamelite drawing clear to the line. And Gamelite, the true champion, is wins by 8 metres. Second Copperway, who tried to break his heart, Gamelite.
Now, why did we play that race specifically, Dan?
Well, Gamelite was a great horse, and it's Cranbourne Pacing Cup night tonight, of course.
What about the applause?
Isn't it fantastic listening to that A, you've got a great name in Gammalite, you've got a great race caller in Brian Martin, and you hear the crowd behind you. I mean, it sends a few little shivers up your spine, and I reckon it might with our next guest as well.
And just really quickly, Matt, going through Terang last weekend when you went to Warrnambool, and well, coming back through Terang, it's the home of Gammalite. There's even a sign there for him. Saw it about...
Not if you go the Hamilton Highway way.
Oh, well, that's getting a little bit technical, but if you go Princes Highway through Terang, you see the Gammalite sign there.
It's great, isn't it, when you go through a town anywhere in Australia and there's a sign that's relative to a great horse. There'd be Tordo up around the Dunkell Way, and you go through Goondiwindi and you know,
well, or any other animal. When we went through Casterton a few years ago, the boys have got a Kelpie, the hometown of the Kelpie. Yeah. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked.
As Brian, I've got
one. That was a very youthful Brian Martin. How are you, Brian?
G'day, guys. How you doing?
Very well. You still sound exactly the same. Long time ago, probably as far as race crowds at big events too, the sound of the crowd, and probably one of the horses closest to your heart, an old Gammalite.
Oh, he was a beauty, because that was, there was a marvellous era of the welcome advices in the late 70s, and the Gammalites, the Pure Steels, the Rip Van Winkle, and it just went on, Don't Retreat, and it was the time when I was calling harness racing, which I loved, and I remember those days that really stood out to me were Kilmore Cup and Cranbourne Cup Day, because there'd be 10,000 to 15,000 people there. It was run at 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, a working day. But they were huge. They were huge. You could hear the crowd behind them. And those horses, and of course, popular on through that time as well. And those horses just excited people and excited race callers, and putters flocked, and they want to be a part of it. And it was a great era, and I'm glad I was around for it.
Did people race in syndicates back then, or did they have four or five mates, or were they individually owned? Why weren't syndicates big in harness racing?
I don't actually remember syndicates actually being in harness racing, because there were big stables sort of dominating through those periods, particularly Vinnie and Bobby Knight. I can't recall syndicates. There may have been. Dan might remember.
Paces Australia. Like the first that I can remember of significant syndications would have been Terry Henderson's Paces Australia, Brian. Yeah. Maybe they were just a bit more affordable, the standard bred horse.
Yeah, well, Terry sort of linked up with the Purdens, and they had great success with some of the champion horses out of New Zealand that won so many wonderful feature races.
Choken, Holmes DG.
Those horses, Mark Hoare, I think, was involved as well with Paces Australia, and then they actually made the transformation from harness racing to thoroughbreds and had success too. They had a couple, I think, a Derby winner in South Australia. They've had one here in Victoria, in the Gallops.
Mark Hoare bobbed up in the news again this week. Did you see the story about Baron Vorster Marcel from Madrid? And Mark was most unhappy with the ride of Barons, and it went to the stewards. And the stewards, after weighing it all up, erred on the side of Barons' ride on a particular horse trained by Paul Prushka. Yeah. So, anyway, hey, Brian, speaking about things that are close to your heart and you're proud of and so on, I remember the first days of Living Legends, and it involved, I remember, Martin O'Connor, Brian Martin, Kerry Gillespie and others with paintbrushes and all sorts of things, putting a lick of paint on a property that you'd found. Take us back, because the hook for this is the tourism award that Living Legends won a couple of weeks ago. Take us back to the origins of Living Legends.
Well, it was designed around Fields of Omar. Fields of Omar was sort of in the twilight of his career, and I think it was around 2004, and Martin O'Connor identified a property out there at Woodlands, an historic sort of farmhouse that actually came out in kit form in 1839. It came out in kit form, landed on the docks, and they sort of transported it up to where it is now at the back of the airport. And that property extended from sort of around from that road that sort of heads out to Sunbury at the back, where people sort of go plane spotting, etc. And that property extended right across to the Hume Highway. It was something like 100,000 acres or something. It was huge way back in the 1800s. And it had, they built a garden around the homestead as well, and stables, because horses actually were tethered out there. There were some racehorses would actually go out there and spell. If you look at the origin of the Hunt Club meetings connected back to Moonee Valley, those Hunt Club meetings actually used to start there. There was sort of virtually a race course there that extended all around the zoned area around there. So it's well over 150 years old. So we sort of got the opportunity through Martin O'Connor to lease the 150 acres that the government took over in 1977. It was the Hamer government, and they took over the land. They purchased the land to give it back to the people. So it's public, well, it's the public state-owned land, and we're able to lease 150 acres, which took all the acreage around the homestead, to turn it into a retirement home for thoroughbreds. And it was built around Fields of Omar. He was in his last couple of years of racing. He was trained at Lindsay Park, so he spent his time over at Angaston in the Barossa Valley. And we're all the owners, the syndicate we put together, we're all Victorians. So we thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if he could be back here? But why don't we create something not only for him, but for these great horses like the Might and Powers, the Betaloos and Ups and the Apache Cats? Because more often than not, when they'd retire, they'd go to an owner or someone's property. And if you're privileged enough to go there for a barbecue, you could go down to the back paddock and see old Might and Power. But we wanted to sort of bring them back to the public because they were used to the adoration of the public on race days and make them feel important again. And that's sort of where it started. We, liquor paint on the fences and building shelters. And it was touch and go. It was difficult. But then when we sort of reached out to people like Nick Moraitis with Might and Power and Terry Henderson was fantastic with the Doremus, all of a sudden they got what we were doing. We were going to take care of them. And the beauty, of course, was that Andrew Clark, the CEO, was a qualified vet and a lover of horses, so the horses are going to be well looked after. We had to have security on the place. There's a little cottage at the back where people actually live and are part of the security to make sure that nothing happens untoward when the sun goes down. And in the middle is this beautiful homestead that's got so much history about it. So all of a sudden, so you joined the dots. It was really going to work. But the important thing was that we didn't have any money to sort of fund it. So we were reliant on people that would send their horse there to, you know, put a decent sort of check on the tail of the horse so we can look after him, because it's like an old people's home. And it grew from there. And I remember with Fields of Omar, when he won the Cox Plate, and we announced his retirement on the Friday, and he won the plate on the Saturday 2006. That was his swan song, so he won two, and he was the oldest horse to win it. And that was Saturday, and at Court to Wait Monday morning, he arrived at Living Legends, and there to meet him was Might and Power, Better Loosen Up, and Doremus. We put him into the yard, the big sort of half-acre paddock with Better Loosen Up. They went behind the shelter. Someone kicked someone. There was a squeal. And they trotted out. They'd sorted out their pecking order, and that was it. And since then, it's grown to Apache Cat, and different horses have come along. Chief De Beers is very popular there, and it's just been fantastic. And also we were able to, between the paddocks, create like a cemetery for horses that have passed on, and that's all important too. But it's bringing the champions, particularly the horses that have had, you know, done wonderful things on the racetrack, but bring them back to the people so you can go out there. It's nothing to sort of enter. It's public land, as I say, but you can sort of get up and close and personal with these great old horses. So see... Living Legends win that award through the RACV last week. It was very, very sort of fulfilling for me. I got off the board about 3 years ago, but it's a great board there with of course, Andrew Clark and the people that put around him. And it's still going well. It got a government grant about 3 or 4 years ago, which was most important to keep the place ticking, maintaining the homestead, looking after the horses. They probably cost around, you know, 10 grand a year to look after because their feet have got to be done. You've got to watch their diet, all sorts of things. You know, the dentist has got to come along and look at their teeth. So we're going to look after these guys. And when you think Better Loosen Up...
Better looked after than we do, Brian.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Better Loosen Up was 30, I think, when he passed away a couple of years ago. So we want them to have longevity and so we can, you know, continue to enjoy them.
And look, winning that award was so important. These horses are also parading on race day. I've got photos every time the past champions parade. I'll go up and I don't take selfies with anybody, but I'll go and take them with these famous horses and the California. Remember, there's quite a few ex-Hong Kong.
Colin McCulloch,
there.
You got a photo with once, didn't you? Yeah. Colin McCulloch?
Yeah, I did. I was very much red-faced, though, Brian. Actually, Brian would have been there that day. You probably remember that Colin McCulloch story. But, look, seeing the champions on the race day, it's quite a thrill. And having been there and called those champions, you know, it puts a little sort of knot in your throat, doesn't it, Brian? I mean, you've got the relationship with Fields of Omar, but calling all of these champions, very much a part of your career, and it wouldn't matter if you're a race caller, an owner, a trainer, a rider, a driver, or a punter, you can have a connection with all of them.
Yeah, you're right, Dan. I'll never forget the day that we took Foo up there and the stable brought him up and he went to the paddock with Better Loosen Up. And I stood there and looked at them and I thought, gee whiz, there's Better Loosen Up. I called him in all these Group 1 races here in Australia, but I was there in November, you know, 1990 in Japan, and here's the horse we own that's just come off winning his second Cox Plate, and here they are in front of me. It was very special.
Personally. You tempted to give him a click up and see who won the battle around the paddock, or
they were going even time when they left me.
Hey, Brian.
Just very fulfilling. Yeah.
Simone has a lovely daughter called Darcy, and Darcy wants to do something over the school holidays. How up and about is Living Legends over the summer holidays for families and kids?
Oh, yeah, very, very, very up and about, Matt, because there's some terrific barbecue areas under the trees. The homestead's really worth looking at, the old stables at the back. And then you just wander down around the horses, and I can tell you, in the cafeteria, which is built into the centre of the homestead, and there it makes the most fantastic scones, jam and cream. Brilliant.
Oh,
brilliant.
It sounds like we will be paying you a visit. It's one of those things, Brian, I keep saying, I must go there. And when you've got horses at home, you think, oh, do I really need to go and see other horses? But I think I will make an effort these school holidays. But what do you find, who do you find is the biggest type of visitor? Is it just a general public, or do you find that it's more horse enthusiasts?
Combination of both, Simone. Interestingly enough, we get quite a few visitors from Hong Kong. You know, we've got Silent Witness there, and Silent Witness was the champion who was bred here in Australia and sold through the sales here, and then went on to be one of the greatest sprinters of all time, winning in Japan, and of course was the hero of Hong Kong. And quite often the trainer and the jockey will fly out from Hong Kong, get a cab from the airport, come across to Legends, spend an hour or two with old Silent Witness, and get the flight home to Hong Kong. Believe it or not.
Wow. Mm. Well, it's close to the airport, right. So it's easy, isn't it?
Well, that is part of the plus, and it's sort of very, very provincial as well, so it's got the best of both worlds. Hey, Brian, good on you. Lovely to reflect. I do remember those early days, and especially through Kerry Gillespie talking about the creation of this Living Legends, and the Tourism Award was a massive feather in the cap, and that's fantastic. So thanks for joining us on Cracking the Codes, and we'll see you around the traps.
Good to talk to you guys.
Dan, that was fascinating about Living Legends, and you've sort of got a bit of a backstory about a current Living Legend when you were traipsing around the back blocks of Western Australia.
Well, I was. It was during the Inner Dominion, the Joe Fest Inner Dominion, for memory, and went quite a few places and went south on the way. Northerly was making his comeback. We went past Fred Kersley's place and the Falcon Strike, the Gary Hall team with their famous horses. It was a wonderful day, as you could appreciate, both as a lover of the industries, but also from your work capacity. We went to Bunbury, another trainer, Andrew DeCampo, went to see, had a few horses there. He trains at a place called Capel, just south of Bunbury. Now, as we got to Capel, not a big place, but there was a sign at the back of the local pub, and the sign said, Rogan Josh lives here, written in texter with a little arrow pointing to it. You know, so the group of us that were there, and there were some trainers and drivers, and John Dunn was there with us as well. We jumped out, looked familiar, because I called Rogan Josh, so it was in a Melbourne Cup, so it was important to me. We all went through the barbed wire fence, took photos, group photos of Rogan Josh. It's just remarkable that he was in a little-ish paddock on his own. There was no other horse there behind the pub at Capel. And it was only a couple of years later that he ended up going to Living Legends, which has been his home ever since. But you just wouldn't have thought to come across a sign like it's almost like seeing the Loch Ness Monster. You just had no idea that it sort of came to you rather than you went to
it. Well, Lurtadug Park Road, where my parents still live in Bacchus Marsh in Darley, there was a stud farm that is now a market garden, and it's true, it was and it was written on there on a plaque, former home of Carbine.
Wow.
And it was the former home of Carbine. And Underbank, just a few k's away, was where Farlap used to adjust in Bacchus Marsh. So I'm rich with these stories from Bacchus Marsh.
But it's so enlightening. You go through Goondiwindi, and you know, it mentions Gunsinda, various places. If it mentions a greyhound, or particularly a horse, you know, the horses were always my heroes, and Rogan Josh was for a number of reasons. But some of the horses that Living Legends have got or had in Northerly, Doremus, Bomber Bill, Regal Roller, Sky Heights Takeover Target, Silent Witness, Zarvit Zipping, Faulkner's just been added there, another great California memory who you know I love. And nearly everybody that talks about Living Legends, I show them the latest selfie I took with the great horse from Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's getting a bit weird. But
well,
anyway.
I guess it is. But look, they're heroes. Yep. And they need to continue to be celebrated.
And they don't all end up at Living Legends. There's a few little avenues, and the police force is one of them. And there's a horse, a legendary horse, owned by a guy who's got a couple of mates. His name's Scott Gallen, but he's also mates with Joe Punda and the Drifter, and they've never all been seen in the same place at the same time. And Scotty was a part owner of London Fog, who was almost too famous for Living Legends, so they decided to go to the police force instead. And Scotty joins us. How are you, Scotty?
Good afternoon, guys. How are we?
Good, thanks, Scott.
How did the police force angle come up with the Fog?
It was a great story. The Fog, we had to unfortunately retire him this year, and within a week, the key managing owner, Ben Casanilia, he had a contact in the police force, and they said, bring him up to have a trial. So within a week, he was retired as a racehorse up to Melbourne having a trial, and he then got through his paces and they kept him, and now he's walking the street.
It's an unbelievable story, Scott, because as you know, thoroughbreds aren't really probably always the quietest horses in reactive situations, but he's just a standout, isn't he? You would expect it perhaps more from a standard bred to get put in that situation and not be too flustered, but a remarkable horse that he can handle everything that's thrown at him and not be reactive.
Yeah, no, the head trainer there was away, and she told us, if I was here, I wouldn't have taken a racehorse straight away like that, because they're normally too flighty and they have to calm down a lot. But the Fog was a favourite at the two stables he went to because he's a big horse, but just so docile. He'd just stand there and watch the world go by. So clearly that's a strength for the new job he's got, and they loved him, and now the police love him.
The trial itself, what's the test to see if you're good enough to be a police horse?
It's in a big horse show sort of shared ring, and they wave flags right at him. They try and spook the horse, basically, and he has to push this big ball around and just be able to trot around calmly. And all it is about trying to distract and spook him, as if protesters and other things are going on around him. And the Fog just stands there and oblivious to it all. That's why he passed so well.
Has he done his first protest yet?
No, apparently not. I think he's done a few shopping centre appearances, Matt, and he sort of walked a few streets, but they gradually build him into getting some protesters out of the way.
Hey, Scott, he turned out a good horse for you, won over 200,000, but I remember there was a period there, and I'm sure you'll remember better than most, but he did have a bit of a penchant for running second there for a while.
Oh, Dad, we had a horror. We went to, where'd we go? Kyneton one day, he backed him off the map, came back with a black tie, finished last. He eventually broke his mane, the Pakenham, on like a wintry Tuesday morning. It was 11:30, it was raining, it was hopeless. He eventually got there. He did run second a fair bit, and then he found the knack. He had one preparation where he came back. He won the Bland Cup first up or second up over unsuitable distance, and then won at the Valley, went over to Morpheville, won there. He just found his mojo, and we think he spelled up at Warrnambool in the magic waters up there, and something happened. He came back as a different horse, but for a little while...
Maddie, he jumped in that Southern Ocean the other day with his boys. He's come back a different person.
I did. I've come back riddled with pneumonia. Hey, Scotty, I've just... Because knowing that you can... You know, your life doesn't always stick to the path and so on, and then, you know, you have so much to drink sometimes and act inappropriately. You may get arrested by your own ex-racehorse one day, I just realised, if you're in the wrong spot at the wrong time.
There's every chance the Fog will have one look at me and go, nah, let him go. Let that offender go.
With those big doggy eyes of his, just give him a little nod and say, no, he's okay. He's just Scotty. Hey, mate, good on you. Well done. I mean, it's rehoming's an interesting thing, isn't it, with horses? And we talk about it on this show with other, harness horses and greyhounds as well. And it's good to see that the old Fogsters found a nice afterlife career.
Well, it's such a relief as an owner, as you know. I mean, because we fall in love with our horses, even if they're slow or whatever, but they're like part of the family. And then to know that he's okay and clearly loving life doing something else is a big relief for an owner.
Terrific. Good on you, Scotty. We'll see you in the studio here next week.
Look forward to it, guys.
A bit of a theme lately is we've been listening to a few songs we were very popular about the Hello Mr. Postman last week, wasn't it? I've picked out another little song here. See if you can work out where I'm going to with this.
You can't play songs like that to me because I just drift off and lose interest in the show.
Well, it's not just the capital of Jamaica, of course. There's a Group 1 race run in Perth today, and of course it's the Kingston Town Classic. Why is it the Kingston Town Classic?
Well, he won it when it was the Winfield Classic, didn't he?
I think it was actually the Western Mail Classic.
Oh, it might have been, yeah. Yep.
But it was his last ever race start.
And Rare Flyer joined by Kingston Town on the outside, getting closer behind them. Cheeky Trot, Grosvenor and McAlpie. Kingston Town getting closer and Rare Flyer. Kingston Town ahead in front, getting closer, fighting back. But the champion's got it won. Kingston Town by a length over, getting closer.
The winner was one of the greats. The second horse was one of the greatest plunge stories in the history of Australian racing, getting closer. And the third horse was one of the great three-year-olds of the period, Grosvenor, 80s. Grosvenor. Galleon.
What a super field that was, and what a super horse. His last ever race start. That was his 41st start. That was his 30th win. Won 14 Group 1s. After that run, they tried to take him to America, but it didn't work out.
Charlie Whittingham had him in work at Hollywood Park.
Yeah, and it didn't work out. He never raced there. Came back here. I remember him being entered in a race final nomination, but he didn't take his place in the field. But he was a wonderful horse. He wasn't a big horse. He had one of the greatest accelerations of any thoroughbred that I've ever seen. And you only have to go back to replays. When he was a three-year-old and he dominated the Autumn Carnival in Sydney, he won the Rosehill Guineas, Derby, the Tancred, and even the Sydney Cup as a three-year-old. You know, he never raced at an Autumn Carnival in Sydney after his three-year-old year.
Is that
he
right?
He was 4, 5, and 6, yet won the Cox Plates each of those springs.
Well, he had injury niggles and something had to give, and it was usually the order. And he had the beautiful black bridle, Simone. He was, she's a year or two younger than us, Dan, so she might not remember the vintage years of Kingston Town, but he had the white bridle as well, which
and he was a beautiful black horse. Colour and he was a windsucker. You know what a windsucker is. Mm. He would get on the fence there and he'd put his top jaw on and he'd suck the wind back through. It was quite amazing. The quirks that he had, you take his race plates off and in a paddock, he looked like closer to a pony than Look, what a great, one of the greatest horses that I've ever seen. And perhaps still in my eyes is number one, maybe because I was so young and he was so impressionable to me. But he won 30 races. At one stage, I think he went about 20 out of 20 in Sydney.
Mm.
He ran last at his first start. He was a colt. He then got gelded. He raced about 6 or 8 weeks later, and then he just dominated every race that was run in Sydney. For a while, he was known as the Sydney champ, because I think he only won 5 races in Melbourne. He didn't win at Flemington. He ran 2nd in the Melbourne Cup. He ended up winning 2 Caulfield Stakes at Group 1 level, and of course, 3 Cox Plates.
Do you remember the name when I was growing up? You have the news on. You didn't have every other distraction. There was the nightly news, and you did hear of Kingston Town a lot. And I do remember that white bridle on that horse. So thanks for the history lesson, Dan. I love hearing about all this and these horses.
I'm off to Balnarring. Where are you off to?
Cranbourne Cup tonight.
Where are you off to, Simone?
I won't be there, but I'll be looking at the Ballarat Cup heats.
All right. And we will reconvene at the same place, at the same time, next Saturday morning for another edition of Cracking the Codes. We'll see you then. Goodbye.